Are you okay over there? You a little child?
I'm good now.
Okay, perfect. Welcome back to another Barnes Bullets podcast. I'm your host, Dale Evans. I've got Greg Sloan and Mitchell Cookson with me today. And today we are going to talk all about muzzleloader bullets and muzzleloader hunting. So I think that we could tell some hunting stories in here.
Yeah.
It's always fun to do that. You know, I want to kind of approach this. I haven't done a lot of muzzleloader hunting in, I would probably say 15 plus years. So I think probably there's been a lot of changes in muzzleloaders and muzzleloader hunting in that time frame, right? I did it back in the Southeast. I've done a little bit here and there in the Midwest, but it was just like a single hunt, 3 days, no big deal, right? It was back when I was doing some like rider events and things like that. So it was just like, hey, show up. This is what you're doing.
Right.
But with that, I mean, I kind of want to do this with fresh eyes and kind of from an audience perspective of learn as much as I can about what we have available, maybe even hint at some things that we could be working on potentially. Okay. And also I have a little few questions because I get questions all the time from friends that, you know, obviously knows that I work here and everything else. So that's kind of my thought process with this one is, you know, I kind of want to take a deep dive into this for the audience, but also be, you know, learn myself. So,
yeah.
You know, how would you like to teach me right off the bat? Obviously, I know that there's a 45 caliber and a 50 caliber.
Yeah. I think first let's kind of just hit what Barnes offers with that.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the Barnes muzzleloader bullets, we have a couple different product lines, but they're all designed for modern inline muzzleloaders.
There we go.
And what I mean by that goes back actually quite a ways, as you're aware. You know, we've been using inline muzzleloaders for, heck, I don't know, 30 years now,
right?
Probably. So they're not that modern anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we talk about traditional muzzle loading, you know, with different ignition types and, you know, conicals and round ball and all the way back to some, you know, percussion cap type stuff, you know, none of the Barnes muzzle loading products are designed for those old, you know, traditional firearms.
Right.
You know, these are all for modern inline type muzzle loaders with modern ignitions and propellants. All the way even to some of the, what I'll call more high performance, you know, high velocity, ultimate type muzzle loaders.
Yeah.
Like the Remington Ultimate built off of 700 action with the Magnum MZ, and we can get more into that in detail. But yeah, they're all for modern inlines. They all use a sabot. Mm-hmm. You know, these are what we call saboted projectiles. We do offer a 45 cal and a 50 cal, a couple different versions. Different weights. Mm-hmm. And then we even offer a few 54 calibers. And the plastic sabot is what gets us to that diameter. So the bullets are undersized.
Yeah.
And then with the sabot, they make up the difference to be 50 caliber. For example, on the 50 cal, the bullet diameter, the actual projectile, is 0.451 diameter. And on the 45 caliber, the actual bullet diameter is 0.4. It's a 40 caliber bullet.
So with the sabot, like what is really the purpose of the sabot? Like obviously, yes, it's the size of the diameter of the bore, but I mean, what purpose does it have if you're going to have such a smaller diameter bullet?
Yeah, it serves a couple. It has some advantages. Really, one being that muzzleloaders have a lot of variation on the gun side of bore diameter.
Okay.
Gun to gun, you know, gun manufacturer to gun manufacturer, some are slightly tighter bores than others.
Yeah.
And where we're actually having to load these manually,
right,
from the muzzle,
right,
it's a balance of having it seal up enough,
okay,
to not have gas blow by, you know, all the way to no resistance where the bullet literally could work its way down the barrel while you're out walking around hunting, which obviously is not a good scenario.
Yeah.
Allows your powder to move and you can end up having some,
get moisture in your powder,
bad ignition, some pressure spikes, those kind of things. But really, it's a balance of being able to load the projectile down the bore easily enough, you know, and we can get into details as to some of the different lines and their design for tight bores and loose bores and those kind of things. But the sabot allows us to be able to load the projectile easy enough with enough resistance that it will seal up and not allow gases to blow by. And it is actually what's contacting the rifling to spin up the projectile.
Got it.
Right? These are all spin stabilized projectiles with rifling. And so it is actually the sabot that engraves in the rifling.
Okay.
And spins the bullet, the projectile. It acts as one projectile. So Mitch, I don't know, you're the engineer, you can give us a more technical explanation, but
yeah, I think we need to dumb it down for Dale.
You do. Yeah. I mean,
I thought you were gonna go more technical.
No,
sorry.
I gotta dumb it down.
He can do that too, like as he gets, like you gotta kind of slowly like work me up. So,
okay.
So dumb it down and then get to your technical side.
Just a quick point that maybe isn't obvious to some people. Traditional firearms, it actually engraves into the rifling. So your bullet diameter is your groove diameter. So for a 30 cal rifle, your bullet is 308, your groove diameter is 308. So ideally these bullets would be groove diameter in a muzzleloader, but there's no way you can push that down by hand.
Right.
So yeah. You have to make it smaller and you have to use a malleable material to do that. So it's gotta be a little bit smaller. I guess there's a little bit of engraving that goes on. And that's why you use plastic, and that's how you can get it. You load it from the muzzle loader.
Right.
So you put your powder in, then you put the projectile in and push it down. So the plastic gives a little bit of malleability to actually push it down. And then the different sabots, which fun fact is French. It's not Sabot. That's what I grew up
and most family and friends call it a sabot, so it happens.
It is.
We'll excuse it, but proper terminology is sabot.
Yeah, I was going to ask that question early on. Is it sabot or sabot? But
it's,
obviously we jumped in that.
It's and French. It means shoe. Tim told me that.
And
so, Tim, if you're listening, I learned one thing. It means shoe in French.
There you go.
And also, if anybody's listening and wants to know the definition of malleable, since he's throwing these crazy terms at us today, it is able to be hammered or pressed permanently out of shape without breaking or cracking.
Yeah.
So
there we go. So malleable. So this is, I mean, we've already learned two things in this podcast and we haven't even been on for 5 minutes. So
that's pretty awesome. Educational.
There you go.
Okay.
Continue with your malleable sabot.
Yeah. So like Greg said, it starts to engrave as you push it down, but it's not to groove diameter. It's maybe in between bore and groove. So you get a little bit of engraving, and then you see on these sabots, they kind of have a skirt on there. And what that is when pressure builds up at the base, they flare out, and that's what fully seals and engraves the sabot, and then it's tied around the bullet, and it spins it up.
So it's acting as one projectile, right?
Mm-hmm.
One
yes.
unit.
So let's go back a little bit further because this has kind of been in my head as soon as
gotta
we...
Gotta dumb it down further?
No, we're not dumbing it down. So originally, right, like let's go to non-modern muzzleloaders, right? There was a patch and a ball.
Correct.
So mm-hmm. when sabots came around, how did a patch and ball like, or how did a sabot really help, you know, change the game, if you will, then from like a patch and ball, right? Because I mean, again, going back to like I was hunting with a muzzleloader 30 years ago, let's mm-hmm. say, or 25 years ago, and I first started out with a patch and ball type of thing and loose powder and all that, right? So then I got into using some sabots, but how did a sabot really kind of help change the game, if you will, from patch and ball?
You know, really, in its simple term, it allows a sleeker, modern projectile to be used, right? It's not just a ball. It's not just a round ball. You know, if you think about external shapes and aerodynamics, we talk a lot about ballistic coefficient, for example. You know, if you think about how aerodynamic is a round ball versus something that is spherical,
or
spitzer-shaped, you know, something that has a nose profile to it. It's going to cut through the air better. It's going to have less wind and drag resistance. It's going to retain velocity better. And so even though they're still muzzleloaders, even out to 50 yards, 100 yards, 150, 200 yards, you can start to see the big advantages from a performance perspective, just from the shape and geometry of the projectile itself.
Right.
And like Mitchell said, the Sabot allows us to load that and seal up and engrave properly. And so part of its accuracy, you know, the accuracy potential, extending the effective range, you know, of not only hitting the target, but then the, you know, we'll get deeper into the bullet performance and expansion, frontal yeah. diameter and all that, the mushrooming, if you will. But really that's kind of the game changer from, you know, patch and ball to a, you know, Sabot with a projectile, is we can shoot more of what would be described as a modern projectile, similar to what you'd have in a rifle, right. in a cartridge, you know, metallic cartridge, with a Spitzer shape to it.
I feel like when modern inline muzzleloaders came out, like, it was a drastic jump from more of that traditional, you know, I mean, I feel like for what, 200 years, give or take, right? There really wasn't a big change from flintlock to like going to more just like cap and that type of stuff. But then when modern muzzleloaders, it was just like this drastic yeah. jump, right? Because you had 209 primer, you started to have the little pellet powders versus loose yeah. powder. I mean, there was all these like crazy and changes. And then you had, you know, Sabots as well.
Yeah, it's a combination. You're yeah. right. It was the gun itself. These are potentially more accurate, higher quality steels being used, materials, the rifling profiles are different. They're faster twist rates, so yeah. they can stabilize longer, heavier bullets, not mm-hmm. just round balls. The accuracy potential, the thermal performance potential, the propellant is a big one.
Right.
The ignition, you know, you brought that up from flintlock to percussion cap to using a 209 primer. Some of the modern stuff, you know, I shoot a Remington Ultimate muzzleloader. You know, I load into a shell, just a cutoff more or less, 308 size shell.
Okay.
That's really just to house the primer, and I'm shooting, you know, Federal 215 Magnum rifle primers in it.
Yeah.
That's my ignition source.
That's what they got in them, 215?
Yeah. Well, that's what I load in them. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was a large pistol or.
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
Large rifle. Yeah. I mean, you can load like a standard large rifle or large rifle Magnum. I've used 210s and 215s with success both ways. But yeah, I generally load 215s whether I need to or not.
Yeah, might as well.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, all of a sudden you think, okay, the advantages in ignition, because if you've ever hunted, and I have not, I'm not a traditional muzzleloader guru. I'm not an expert yeah. on flintlocks and percussion caps. But yeah, I'll go back to even some of the first inlines back in the mid-90s, late 90s. I remember, you know, family members having inline muzzleloaders, but they were not 209 capable. You know, that even came later on.
Yeah.
They were inlines, but they were still like number 11 percussion cap right. for the ignition. But it had to do with the inline comes from with the design of the bolt, the lockup,
right. yeah.
the ignition directly to, you know, through the breech plug,
yeah.
allowing that ignition source to go right to the powder, get a more consistent burn. You can do any sort of research or talk to guys that are traditional muzzleloader hunters, which is cool too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said there as an opportunity.
There that's one challenge. Thing with so muzzle or Montana, right, just recently came out with a late season muzzleloader hunt 4 or 5 years ago now, I think it was. But they made it where it's like you have to use traditional,
right.
you know, cap, loose powder, ball,
yep.
everything.
Which right? and late season generally means cold, snow, wet, right. humidity, and guess what happens?
Pressured animals. Right. right. So like getting close to them is
right. But from an ignition standpoint, there's a lot of failures.
Yeah.
You know, if anyone has ever hunted with that traditional muzzleloading equipment, chances are you've had a misfire. You've had a hang fire.
I have.
Yeah. You've had wet powder. You've had primers that don't work.
Yeah.
You know, they're not ideal, which is, I guess, some of the challenge that some people seek after, which is awesome.
Yeah.
You know, from those primitive weapon hunts. And obviously on the game side, you know, with the regulation, it allows states to offer potentially more opportunities,
right.
you know, with more primitive weapon hunts that are lower success rates.
Well, my thought was that Utah actually has something right here because you can actually use cool muzzleloaders versus Montana doesn't have something. So.
Yeah, they like to go back and forth, though.
Just like change the regs yeah. like randomly.
Yeah, and on the gun side, they haven't been too crazy, but optics wise, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we went for a long time where you couldn't use powered optics. You could use a one power red dot or okay. fiber optics. And then they allowed powered optics, I think around 2017. Mm-hmm. And then what was it, 2024, 2023, right
last,
in there.
Last year was effective, last year. So 2024.
We're back to no powered optics. So red dot, open sights, you know, irons, you know, fiber optics are acceptable. You can still have like a one power prism, or which some states don't even allow that. Some are iron sights only.
Right. Yeah, like, you know, Colorado, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can't have any sort of glass optic, even if it's not powered. So that part of it gets interesting. But yeah, just from the overall progression of modern inline muzzleloaders, you know, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves with kind of some potentially new stuff, but the Barnes offerings as they are now are very effective. I will say that, you know, I mean, we've got tip versions, boat tail versions, you know, 250 grain, 290 grain, 300 grain. Like I said, we have a 195 grain in the 45, which is actually a 40 caliber bullet. Great bullet. We can talk about the Magnum MZ, you know, we can really, maybe we just like go down through the line of each product.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that we kind of derailed where the conversation was going when Mitchell started giving us definitions and crazy words.
I liked it. I liked it.
But let's start to kind of, I guess, bring it back to, you know, we've talked about what a Sabot is and start to talk about like our different offerings that we have. And then, you know, we can kind of go by, you know, I guess it's a subfamily, and then talk about like the different offerings within that subfamily.
So real quick, Greg said they don't work in, I guess, non-modern muzzleloaders, like the flintlock, cap lock, stuff like that. But there's a lot of companies now that actually build those styles for, they call them like Northwest legal. So they're legal in Idaho. And I think there's a few other states that have weird regulations, but they're kind of a modern rifle. And then they still have the cap lock or flint lock, and then you can actually use a Sabot.
Interesting. So so basically you're getting a better bullet, but you still have to use the traditional...
Like ignition.
Ignition.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what was I going to say? Oh, Idaho. I think, don't quote me on this, so don't go hunt this year with Sabots. I'm pretty sure they're getting rid of the Sabot requirement, and or the... It was in Idaho, you couldn't use a Sabot, and I want to say they're bringing it back. I think it's effective next year. Got I don't it. Think you can use it this fall, but you can use copper bullets. They added that, and then you can use a Sabot now. But double check.
Grapevine.
Muzzleloader is interesting, and it's not just muzzleloader. I mean, obviously, we do a lot more recently with like straight wall regulations,
right?
You know, those kind of opportunities, as well as game laws change. As a bullet and ammunition manufacturer, you obviously have to stay on top of where that takes you with product offerings and demand from the consumer. But muzzleloading is tough because across the country, there are so many different variables of regulation.
Right.
You know, on the gun side, the optic side, the propellant side, the ignition side, the projectile side, Sabot, non-Sabot. It's interesting.
And then they change.
So quick question before we start diving into this. If you had to choose, if you were going to like the Midwest, right? Because some of these states, like you said, you can use a shotgun, you can use a straight wall or a muzzleloader in like the same season, right? Which one would you take? Would you take a muzzleloader, a straight wall, or a shotgun if you were obviously hunting whitetails?
Right now,
scope or non-scope?
Scope. Good question. Across the board, scoped.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say you were going to Illinois, for example, or Iowa. I'm not exactly sure.
Which I'm going to go straight wall.
Okay.
But if you'd asked me that question even 3 years ago, if you'd asked me that for the last 20 years, muzzleloader all day long.
Okay.
Like, hands down, I would go with a muzzleloader over a shotgun, over a slug gun.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's just because of the potential performance, the accuracy potential you can get with muzzleloaders with these Barnes, any of them, TEZ, Magnum MZ, Spitfire TMZs, they're incredibly accurate.
Yeah.
Shotguns, they can be effective, don't get me wrong. I'm no shotgun slug hunter expert based off where I live and hunt, but I've done a fair amount of development work on, you know, like the Vortex Expander with the slug loads. And they're, I'm not going to say they're not accurate, but just across the board, I've done a ton of competitor eval with slug loads. And I don't know, I'm not a shotgun fan for hunting with slugs. I would take a muzzleloader all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the repeater, you know.
Right.
You can make that argument, okay, but if I'm shooting not long range and 20 to 50 yards is a long shot and I can run a pump gun that's a repeater and have follow-up shots, you've got a valid argument. But from just like a performance perspective and accuracy, precision, I'd take a muzzleloader.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm same way. I'd go straight wall if I had the choice. And then, yeah, close range shotgun. It is nice having more than one round,
right?
Especially when it gets crazy in the deer woods. You're, if you're doing a drive or deer spooked and you're kind of doing fast shots and you got to follow up and make another one, it is really nice to have a shotgun. But I think if you're over like a cornfield sitting on the edge and you're taking 150, 200 yard shot potentially, I think it's very achievable with the scope. I choose the muzzleloader. I think they just have more accuracy potential, which is crazy saying a muzzleloader is more accurate than a shotgun.
Yeah. But they are. I mean, perfect example, and we already mentioned this with Utah taking away the powered optics.
Yeah.
But, you know, well, I can even step back way back many years ago when Utah was not legal to have powered optics. All my personal muzzleloader, and I've actually done quite a bit of muzzleloader hunting for mule deer. I've done some hogs. I've killed hogs with muzzleloader. I've killed an axis deer in Texas with muzzleloader. And for that Texas hunt, I mean, this is Texas.
Yeah.
You can pretty much do whatever you want.
Right.
When it comes to guns.
Literally.
Literally, yeah. And so, obviously, I was going there with a muzzleloader to test some bullets, you know, to get some content, get some field experience with it. It wasn't because it was a special season or regulation, anything that way. So I threw a scope on a muzzleloader, and I bring this up to say it was the first time I'd actually really messed with any of my personal muzzleloader rifles with a powered optic.
Okay.
Everything up to that point had been iron sights. I wasn't a big fan of red dots, especially if you go back 25 years ago.
Yeah.
But it was amazing putting that scope on it, and I remember shooting it at the range because all of a sudden you could shoot tight groups with iron sights. I'm not saying you can't.
Yeah.
But I was running at that point just some basic open iron sights, some fiber optics. You know, they weren't really designed for precision, you know, and I'll get into a little bit later what I'm running now. And it's pretty impressive what you can do with some of the new stuff. And it's not new. It's actually old, but like an aperture globe style, you know, Western Precision Williams type sight. But anyways, I threw this like just like a 3-9 like loophole VX3 on this. It was actually a TC Encore. And, you know, all of a sudden you're shooting like inch and a half groups at 100 yards with a muzzleloader.
Yeah.
You know, to like Mitchell's point, all of a sudden you're like, wow, that's pretty dang impressive.
Well, and I guess that was my thought, right? Is because personally, for the reason I asked that question is I would have picked a muzzleloader just because, you know, I've done some straight wall hunting. And I think that like you start to see that fall off a lot at 150 yards or so. And I mean, you know, it's a much smaller bullet. Like it doesn't have near the weight. And from the little bit of muzzle loading hunting that I've done in the past, like I said, decade or so, I feel like I've gotten, I'm more accurate with a muzzle loader than I am with a straight wall personally. And I'm going to have that knockdown power at 150 yards or so, even if you're only, you know, let's just say you are only shooting 150 yards, which is the whole reason of a straight wall, a shotgun and a muzzleloader, right? Is reduced range. So,
well, and I think it's kind of, you said maybe you find yourself more shooting more accurately. One, we already talked about, there is potential there. Like some of these are impressive. Like my Ultimate, my Remington Ultimate. I mean, I have shot multiple sub MOA groups with the 250 grain Magnum MZ. I mean, 0.6.
Yeah.
You know, groups with a muzzleloader at 2,400 feet per second. That's pretty awesome.
Right.
You know, also that's a different whole level of performance. But anyways, I do think maybe, and I found myself this way, maybe this is what you're doing, maybe not, but I almost think there's that, even if it's like more subconscious back of your mind, like you only have one shot.
Yeah.
Right. You've got to make it count.
Right.
Like it's not the shotgun. You don't just start pulling the trigger and pumping it. And you know, you've got a tube full of shells. It's, you're going to make that one shot count.
Yeah. I think it's partly that. I think it's partly like knowing that I was basically just hunting Midwest whitetail, right? And I was shooting a lot of does and that type of stuff. So it's like, you're thinking 150 pound animal. Like I would rather have a 250 grain projectile hit that, because more than likely you're just going to just knock it down in its tracks, versus let's say 130 grain straight wall or something like that. Not, I mean, some straight walls I know are heavier, right? The majority of them are. But for the most part, I just think you're going to have such a larger hole when it hits, and just a heavier projectile, that I think that it's just gonna knock down your animal better.
Before we jump into the different offerings, you know, just while we're talking about muzzleloader hunting in general, I think it's worth mentioning in just quick conversation of the appeal of it, right?
Yeah.
It's especially, you look at like Western states, you know, that's obviously majority of what I like to do.
Right.
You know, I love to hunt everywhere I can. You know, I'm not going to pass up any opportunity, but it's really what's driven me to muzzleloader hunting over the last 25 years isn't even so much that I love muzzleloaders. I mean, I'll get frustrated with them.
Like, yeah.
You know, I'm more of a rifle guy. I'd rather shoot a rifle, definitely. I'd rather go load metallic cartridge. But it's just the opportunity to hunt. It's that different opportunity for different seasons.
Right.
Draw odds are potentially better.
Yeah.
You know, there's a challenge aspect of it that maybe is appealing. You know, maybe like we've talked before about maturing as a hunter. Maybe that primitive weapon hunt is a driving factor to bring a hunter towards muzzleloader hunting.
Right.
You know, it's more of a challenge potentially. But it's really, for me, it's just the opportunity that's opened up. It's different seasons, different times of the year potentially, depending what state you're in. Like I said, maybe it's a little bit better draw odds compared to like a rifle hunt. You know, it's not as challenging as an archery.
Right.
You know, definitely, because all of a sudden I still have a gun.
Yeah.
You know, potentially even with a scope that I can shoot 150, maybe 200, 250, 300 yards, depending what your setup is.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think that's something. If I look back at my muzzleloader hunting career, a lot of what's driven me to muzzleloader hunt isn't so much that I just love shooting muzzleloaders.
Right.
You know, it's not that I'm so just this muzzleloading fanatic that wants to go shoot them all year long just for a good time.
Yeah.
It's really just, it's another opportunity to go hunt with different seasons, different draw odds. You know? So,
yeah, I mean, I definitely fall into that category as well. Like I've always considered myself an equal opportunity hunter. If whatever's legal and is in season, like that's what I'm game to go do. You know, I've always joked around that it's like, if you tell me that I can only hunt with a spear or with a slingshot, like I'm going to figure out a way to go do it just because I want to be out there. So
yeah,
I'm with you on that. Okay. Let's start jumping into our offerings.
We'll let Mitchell start.
Mitchell goes.
We'll see what we got here.
It's like Christmas morning.
Let's start with the 45 since it's the smallest. Oh, that's it. I'm blind.
Yeah, we just have one 45 cal offering. It's the 195 grain. It's under the expander line, so we have quite a few different bullets under that line in 45 cal, 50 cal, and 54 cal. But just one offering in 45 cal. And every bullet and offering, I guess every product line and caliber have a different sabot color. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how you can tell them apart. So these are the tan sabots, but it's got more of a Spitzer shape versus this big hollow point, which the 50 cals have on the expander line. But
so what makes the expander line versus
just no tip?
Okay, yeah. No tip.
Non-tipped, yeah.
Which is a, requirement. Oregon has no plastics requirement, but you also can't have a sabot, so that doesn't really help.
Yeah.
But yeah, all these muzzleloaders across the board, I can talk in general, they're six-sided. That's what differentiates them versus most TSXs. Some of our flat noses for straight balls and stuff are six-sided too. They have six pedals.
There we go.
And pistol bullets too. But across the board, muzzleloader bullets are six pedal. They have big, deep, open cavities, and they expand pretty dang impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, huge.
They're actually pretty dang incredible. I've killed three deer with them, and every one of them, they just absolutely hammer.
Yeah.
You got to be careful because they lose a lot of velocity quick because their BC on this 145 is only 176, which is pretty typical for a muzzleloader.
Right.
So as long as you keep it within reason, but they're absolute hammers.
How far are the shots on those deer that you're talking about?
40 yards, 100 yards, and 175.
Wow. And that was that was here in Utah?
Two in Utah, one in Colorado.
Okay.
So this one was the 175 yards. And you can see they open at extremely low velocities. I know people say, well, copper bullets, they don't expand at low velocities. They do. I mean, it depends on product line where they're
what it was designed to do.
Right.
So these are designed for muzzleloaders where they only start at 1,900 to 2,200 feet per second. I mean, you'll get good expansion down to dang near subsonic velocities.
Yeah, we actually test these for what we call a low end into our water tank for production testing. We test a lot of these down to actually 1,100 feet per second.
Wow.
And at 1,100 feet per second, we're getting, you know, literally almost double diameter expansion. I mean, I pulled up some data from a most recent run of a 50 cal TEZ, the 250 grain, and at 1100, we averaged 3/4 of an inch for frontal diameter when it's expanded. I mean, think about that.
It's, well, one of the things, though, is like, you know, you say 1100 feet per second, and everybody automatically thinks about like a rifle, and 1100 feet per second might be 600-800 yards.
Right.
You know, that might only be 125, 150 yards out there. So really, it's just a, you know, going back to what Mitchell was kind of saying, is like you're losing speed so quickly with these large projectiles.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It depends the velocity of the gun. I mean, there's pretty big variation in muzzle velocity on muzzle loaders. If we're talking a 250 grain bullet to 290 grain bullet,
right.
Are you shooting, you know, if you mentioned pelletized propellant, you know,
right.
I go back to when I first started doing inline, I shot Pyrodex pellets, you know, like the 50 grain equivalent.
Yeah.
And so at that point, it was when they were starting to get what they were calling Magnum capable rifles.
Yeah. And you shot three pellets.
And you could shoot three pellets. Yeah. And, you know, depending on the gun, the bullet, you were probably in that 2000 foot per second muzzle velocity range, 2100 maybe, you know, and just, I got some numbers in front of me. That's, you're starting to get on the, I mean, really, if you can hit, well, let me do this number again.
As you're kind of looking at that, one thing that I was thinking about is, I know that for a long time, right, like those shoot through chronographs didn't really do well with muzzleloaders, right? Like because of all the gas or whatever you want to say coming out the end. Where do you find or do you feel like the new Garmins can actually pick up that projectile pretty well on chronos if guys are out there trying to figure out what their speed is and everything else?
I've had good luck with Garmins and muzzleloaders. I've never had issues.
Okay.
I haven't done a ton of it, but I've done enough that I have not had any issues picking up muzzleloaders.
Okay.
Obviously the Ehler equipment we use in the range, we don't have any issues with our sky screens. But
I'm just trying to think if, like, you know, there's people out there, right, that are trying to figure out what their muzzle velocity is to potentially figure out what their downrange velocity is. So they kind of start to figure out what their, you know, what their max distance could be or something.
Yeah.
Obviously, most of the time it's going to be more about, like, how well you can shoot versus what the actual bullet's going to perform to.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard good things on the Garmin with muzzleloaders. Of course, you got the Sabot, which could throw it off.
Right.
I haven't heard it does that. It could hit your chronograph too. But a really cool side note, when we shoot Doppler radar and shoot shotguns or muzzleloaders, you'll see the velocity track of the bullet, and then you'll actually see the velocity track of the Sabot. And it's like this, you know, it loses velocity super quick, and you can see, oh, it went out like 50 yards, and you go look for it.
Yeah, we'll pick up the track. Back to the 1,100 foot per second low end that we mentioned. Again, this isn't a water tank. That's just a velocity that we control the bullet for production.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's a good indicator on this one because we are expanding so large at that 1,100. I would use this one as a potential. Everything else, you know, has to be considered as well. Accuracy, you know, precision. But say you do have a scoped muzzle loader, that bullet, if you're talking the 50 cal 250 grain, like in a TEZ, and you're 2,000 feet per second at the muzzle, which would be a typical like three pellet type charge, you're actually getting expansion out to 300 yards and beyond.
Yeah. So it's not losing speed as quickly as I was anticipating it.
Yeah, it depends. And like that 45 cal is actually an interesting one because that little 195 grain in even standard, you know, I'm not talking CVA Paramounts, I'm not talking Remington Ultimates or some of these custom jobs built on bolt action receivers. I'm talking just your, you know, like your CVA Acura type, you know, TC Encore, but in a 45 cal.
Yeah.
Because of the smaller diameter and the light weight of the 195 grain, you can actually hit smoke and fast velocities with that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, 2,400 feet per second is entirely doable with standard, you know, three pellet type charges.
Gotcha.
Which you start running that 195, even with the BC of 0.175, did you say?
176.
176. I mean, you're all of a sudden you're with that one, you're hitting that 1100 range at about 300 yards.
Okay.
So even with that low BC, I would say you know, obviously you have to factor in other variables and potential factors, but the bullet will expand, you know, well beyond 200 yards on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the six pedal design, super deep cavity, and then we actually anneal them too. They're in sabots, so they don't gum up your rifling.
Yeah.
But you work hard on them so much, we build them on transfer presses. We're not machining bullets at barns. Most people know that, but so we really anneal them to get that max expansion, get to that lower velocity, and that's it's really pretty dang impressive when you look at it.
Yeah.
And no, the cool. Animals don't like it.
Like, yeah.
I mean, you're putting dang near an inch hole.
Right. From.
Yeah, I actually, so here's a quick hunting story. You know, I mentioned already I've done quite a bit of muzzleloader hunting. Not as much in the last 5 years, but my first deer that I ever killed was with a muzzleloader. And crazy enough, it was actually with a Barnes expander. You know, obviously back then I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
You know, I obviously wasn't employed quite yet.
Yeah.
And I had heard of Barnes. I knew a little bit about Barnes, but it was just the muzzleloader bullets that we happened to purchase. You know, I bought a new Knight disc rifle. It was kind of the new latest, greatest at the time. Had a thumb hole, stainless steel.
Man.
Yeah.
Laminate stock.
It was pretty cool. Yeah. It was actually the it was synthetic. The the composite stock. Fiber optic sights, which were pretty cool back then. But yeah, I killed a small, just little 2x3 mule deer. It was only probably an 80 or 90 yard shot.
Yeah.
But that was pretty cool. And then a couple years later, I'd actually killed a pretty decent little 4-point. Again, with that expander, the 250 grain expander out of my 50 cal night disc. And it was we had a rangefinder then, which was pretty exciting at the time.
Was it one of the big ones that weighed like 4 pounds?
It wasn't huge, but I mean, it was compared to today's rangefinders. It was a Nikon rangefinder.
Okay.
I think you could be lucky if you picked up a tree at 300 yards.
Yeah.
But we thought it was pretty neat at the time.
Right.
But anyways, we found this buck, ranged it. It was like 175 to 180 yards. Sat down, got steady. Put my iron sights on the deer, pretty much covered up the deer, but took a shot and I hit it just behind the shoulder and it piled up.
So nice.
I think I was like 16 or 17 years old, but that's kind of started my whole muzzleloader and my first experience with Barnes products in the field, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. All right. So we did the expander MZ for 45 cal. Did you put these in order? I mean, I guess we have more. Yeah. So,
we can go to 50. In the expander line, we have a 250 grain. We also have a 300 grain. And like Mitchell said, those are non-tip. They have a big open cavity.
Right.
That's the black sabot in the 50 caliber. And then staying with 50 caliber, we also have the Spitfire TMZ, which is tipped and boat tail. It has a yellow colored sabot. We have the 250 grain and 290 grain options there. And then we have the TEZs, which are the blue sabot.
Okay.
Those are actually a flat base, really similar bullet. The nose profile is the same. They're both tipped. They're both going to function the same. And really, I want to focus on these two bullets for a minute, and I'll even include the Magnum MZ, which is the green sabot. The big purpose there, the Spitfire TMZ, was introduced first with the yellow sabot. Very accurate, great performing bullet. It is the boat tail version. If you're really hung up on that, I don't get too worried about it in these muzzleloader bullets. But anyways, what happened though is at that time, and we've been building this bullet for quite a few years, a lot of the popular guns on the market started to get what I'll call tight bore. And guys ran into issue in the field with the Spitfire TMZs if they had these tight bore guns where they really struggled to get the projectile down the bore, right? Okay. You took your ramrod, especially once your barrel's fouled.
Yeah.
You know, you go shoot a shot or two, it's fouled. You're loading your gun in the field. Say you took a shot, you're trying to reload it to get a follow-up shot or a potential follow-up shot. And man, you could barely get that ramrod down. You know, you might've been, you got a couple inches, you're pushing on it with all your might, you're beating on it against a tree or something. You know, it wasn't an ideal scenario. But then they worked awesome in other guns, you know, if your bore diameter, depending on where it was at. And it really was a struggle for us as a bullet manufacturer, because it's hard to know what gun is the guy going to have, right? The end user, where's his bore at? There was so much variation from gun to gun, gun make to gun make.
Yeah.
And so that's what drove us to introducing and offering the TEZ, and the EZ stands for easy load.
Yep.
And that blue sabot is actually a little bit smaller diameter. And so for those type bore guns, that was the one we always recommended, you know. And I saw a lot of I'd say more at that time frame, like a lot of your TC, your Omegas, your Encores, starting to get in some of the CVAs and some of the tradition branded guns, some of these newer break action type muzzle loaders. Generally, the TEZ seemed to work a little bit better. Based off my own personal experience, I think a lot of like I mentioned, like my Night Disc back in the day, those always worked fine with the TMZs.
Okay.
But it really just depends the gun you have.
Got it.
Yeah, and then we have the 54 cal. We don't sell a ton of those. There's not a ton of 54 cal guns out there, but I'm trying to even, I'll have to pull it up. I can't even think off the top of my head. I want to say
54 cal.
They're 300 grain.
Yeah, 300 and 325.
We do 325, yeah.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, you know, you kind of hit on it there, right? Of the TMZ and the TEZ, right? But we kind of talked a little bit about it offline before we started, right? Is like, we do have a boat tail and then we have a flat base. Like,
yeah.
What's your thoughts on why you would shoot one over the other?
You know, I can get the appeal for most people to want the boat tail because it is a slightly higher BC. I want to say the BC comes in like 0.223, somewhere right around there on the boat tail 250 grain version.
210.
210. Versus what is it like 0.195 on a 250 grain flat right. base.
Yep.
So not a huge difference and 15 points of BC.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think in real world application for the ranges, you're going to be shooting a muzzleloader maybe out to 200, 250 yards, you're splitting hairs.
Yeah.
It really comes down to the sabot itself. Is your gun a tight bore or is it a loose bore? And that's really going to determine, are you shooting the TMZ with the yellow sabot or the TEZ with the blue or even the green, the Magnum MZ? And I didn't talk about that one yet. The Magnum MZ with the green sabot, the bullet itself, the 250 grain bullet, is the exact same bullet that goes into the TEZ in the blue sabot.
Another fun fact, it's the same bullet in our 20 gauge shot shell ammo.
Yeah.
So that's world renowned, known as some of the best shot shell ammo on the market.
Right.
Phenomenal performance, but yeah, 20 gauge shot shell, Magnum MZ, and the TEZ, it's all the exact same flat base 250 grain bullet. Yeah. It's just different sabots.
Yeah,
got it.
They're 451 diameter projectiles. The Magnum MZ originally was designed for use in the Remington Ultimate muzzleloader. So this is the rifle that was built on a Remington 700 action. It was designed with this modern ignition source where it's actually like a little, it's literally a shell. It's a metallic case.
Okay.
And it's primed with a rifle primer.
Yeah.
And close it on a bolt. It goes over the breech plug. And it was rated for 4 777 pellets, 50 grain. So a 200 grain charge.
Yeah.
I actually shoot Blackhorn 209 in mine, loose powder. I've had great success with that. But the Magnum MZ, the big difference there, that green sabot is a different material. It's a different mold. It's a different sabot itself. And it's stronger. It's more robust. It holds up to those higher pressures and velocities versus the blue sabot.
Yeah.
So that was really the intended purpose. We launched it as a Magnum MZ product for use in whatever gun you have. And honestly, today and in the last probably I'd say even 2 to 3 years,
yeah,
I've actually been recommending the Magnum MZ over the TEZ, even for guys that are only shooting normal like 3-pellet type charges.
Right.
And the reason being, depending on the rifle, I've actually seen better accuracy at those 3-pellet, you know, 150 grain equivalent type charges with the Magnum MZ over the TEZ. The TEZ can shoot awesome. It can shoot great. Especially if you're only shooting 2 pellets, or some velocity that's equivalent to something like a 2-pellet. Certain rifling profiles, certain guns, it works awesome with 3 pellets. But if you're not getting good accuracy with a 250 grain TEZ, switch to the Magnum MZ. I would almost guarantee you fix your accuracy problems.
Got it.
Okay. I think the only time you want to shoot the TEZ if you're not shooting it is if you can't load it.
Yeah,
if you can't load the TMZ or the Magnum MZ, then shoot the TEZ. If you're shooting the TEZ, give the Magnum MZ a shot. It might shoot a little bit better.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I have yet, I'm not saying you couldn't have it. You know, there could be a gun that will not load the Magnum MZ very easily once fouled. I've yet to see it.
Yeah.
I've shot Magnum MZs in TC Encores, TC Omegas, CVA Acuras, Remington Ultimate Muzzleloader, CVA Paramounts. I mean, I've not run into an issue where I can't load the Magnum MZ. And this is even fouled. I mean, I can shoot up to 10 shots in my Ultimate without cleaning and still be able to get, you know, decent to where you're loading it. That's with Blackhorn 209 propellant. It's pretty clean burning.
I was just going
to
say, like, that's maybe two shots with 777.
Yeah, 777's a different story than Blackhorn for sure.
Yeah.
It's definitely a good point to bring up.
Okay, so we've gone over products quite a bit here.
I got one more.
Oh, got one more.
Got our aligner tool.
Aligner tool.
Really nice. So the ramrod that comes with your muzzleloader, it's not going to fit our shape. It'll fit it kind of, but it'll usually leave a pretty good ring on the bullet. So these are just turned brass, same as our banded solids. But just turn brass to match that OGI profile that fit it perfectly. So we have this 50 cal one that works for the Magnum MZ, the TMZ, and TEZ. We have a 45 cal one, a 54. So they just thread right onto your ramrod.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are 1032 thread. So you just thread off what you got, put these on. It's only $11. It's a great accessory.
And people can find that directly on our website in the accessories, like under merchandise, correct?
Yep.
Okay. I have a few random questions to see how we can wrap all this thing up in a bow. Why do you think that there are states that are going away from SBOs? And how are we thinking about addressing that?
Yeah, I think originally, you know, if you look at, and I don't have all the data, or the exact history, but at least on some of these states, the original intent was actually to control, right? It was to keep it more primitive. It was actually the SBOW was viewed as a performance advantage.
Right.
And so when they regulate against SBOWs, it's actually to try to keep it more primitive weapon.
Yeah.
Obviously, the markets usually come up with a workaround.
Right.
And next thing you know, we're actually pushing the performance envelope the other way.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was originally, I think, why states are, the states that have regulations against a SBOW, in their mind, it's a way to keep it more of a primitive weapon and kind of regulate the performance advantage of that projectile.
So,
which I don't think works.
Right.
That was the intent.
That was the intent. Exactly. Good point. That was the original intent.
But it ended up, because people found workarounds, right? And there's other manufacturers that are making other types of bullets.
Right.
Yeah, you can use a skirt that doesn't go, usually they'll say bullet has to be bore diameter, so you can have a skirt behind the bullet that kind of acts as a pusher plate.
Got it.
Or actually this cool Thor bullet. It's not a Barnes branded product, but it's built by Barnes.
Yeah.
And that's actually what I use in Colorado, because you can't use a SBOW in Colorado.
Got it.
So it's got an actual metal skirt that's attached to the bullet. It's all built in one. It's built by Barnes. So same Barnes performance.
Yep. Same whatnot. Cavity. It's going to expand like a expander MZ.
Mm-hmm. But that's just another workaround that you can do. So, yeah, the intent was to limit that and kind of create more of a challenge. But you just work around it as a user, and manufacturers are doing the same thing.
Right.
And that's why you probably seen Idaho go away from it. They probably figured out that, hey, this is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Right. Okay. So staying on that topic of, you know, being more primitive, less primitive, whatever you want to say, what are your thoughts on like the Fire Stick type of muzzleloaders?
I haven't done a ton of work with them personally, so I can't really say from like firsthand experience, success or not. My view, I prefer loose propellant across the board. You know, a lot of these, the idea is to make it easier to load.
Yeah.
It's almost like pre-assembled charges,
right,
or the projectile and the powder all in one, so you can load faster.
Yep.
You you know, those types of, there's been multiple products on the market.
Also, you could probably argue safety a little bit, right? Because you don't have any propellant down the barrel. Because a lot of people will preload their muzzleloader, then walk and load their 209 primer right before they're going to take a shot or something like that, right? So, yeah, maybe a little bit of safety, right? If you're getting in a deer stand or something like that, you don't have to load it until you're actually in the stand. So that's really the only, again, going back like a decade now that I've done any muzzleloader stuff is using a 209 primer. And a quick little hunting story just to kind of wrap that is I was in Illinois. We were doing a muzzleloader hunt, and I had killed a buck like a day and a half early. So I was just on doe patrol, and the farm was like, hey, look, like we want to shoot as many does as we can. We need to kind of take care of that. So I had a fire stick muzzleloader. I bought two doe tags, and I was like, well, I'm not going to try to fill this other one until basically, obviously, like, yeah. Get in a blind, literally hour before dark, doe comes in or some does come into this cornfield. I shoot the one, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, man, like, do I really want to load this muzzleloader? Because I had to leave the next day. And I was like, if I load it, then you have to unload it, right? And there's only one way to do that. So I was like, I'm not going to load this thing. And literally like 5 minutes later, like 15 minutes of daylight left, like here comes some more does. And I quickly like load the thing. And having that fire stick made it nice because now all I got to do is get the bullet, you know, down or the sabot down in the muzzle and load it through the back. So it was just that much easier. And it's quick, right? It's got it's like an 80, 100, and a 120 charge or something like that that you can shoot out of it. So it's a pretty interesting thing, but I can see why, you know, I think it's only legal in like 17 or 22 states, something like that, right? So it's kind of gaining steam, but at the same time, it's, you know, I think that there's a lot of states that want to try to keep it as primitive as possible, but at the same time, it's like they'll give on some stuff over here, but they won't give on this, and then vice versa, right? Other states are like, well, we'll give on this, but we're not going to give on the on this side of it. So
yeah,
it's pretty interesting.
I will say that more from a propellant, you know, comment on my own personal use and experience, I for a lot of years when I was younger did a lot of muzzleloader hunting, like I said, but I was very much a fan of the pellets.
Yeah.
Because I had convinced myself they were just easier, right? Yeah. It's like they're easier. I don't have to worry about weighing out charges. Right. I don't have to have any sort of little, you know, powder tube or anything like that.
Did you start to find that like those pellets weren't as accurate as you could be?
It is that. Eventually I evolved and changed as I learned more and spent more time, you know, testing different muzzleloaders setups and loads and propellant types. And I eventually went to loose, which I'd always avoided because in my mind, like I said, I think if you've never shot loose powder in a muzzleloader in the field, like maybe there's this little hesitation because there's, I don't know, you've read something or heard something or you've convinced yourself it's too big of a hassle. It's really not. It's as simple as could be.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty tough.
No, it's not.
When I shot my buck in Colorado, I missed first. So I had to reload. The stupid thing had no idea what was going on. It was early season, so they're kind of not spooked. So I had loose powder, Blackhorn 209, which is the way to go, put it on. I swear I dumped half on the ground. And at that point, what do you do? You can't, like, they're pre-measured charges.
Right.
I was like, all right, I'm just going to do it. And next shot hit.
Nice.
But when you get flustered, a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But it depends on your tube.
It depends on your tube design. There's a lot of different options out there. I even have like a little funnel that I drop mine in and dump the tube, and they're all pre-measured.
Funnel would be the way to go.
You have to add a funnel. I actually really have to because my Ultimate actually has a muzzle brake. And so I have a little funnel that's 3D printed. I drop in there. I have all these little pre-charged tubes that are weighed out. I go by weight of Blackhorn 209. I just dump it in, put my bullet in, put down the ramrod. It's consistency. It's consistent velocity. I think it's just more control to even tune the load a little bit. You know, you're not set with these predetermined charges, pelletized propellant. I'm a huge fan of the Blackhorn 209.
Well, and going back to the fire stick, like that's kind of what I did is I had the 80, the 100, and 120. So I was just like testing the different loads to figure out how I could get the most accurate that I could. So I was like totally just playing back and forth. But with loose powder, you could go down a lot more narrow. Yeah,
and right? I don't think you can. I will say, at least in the experience I've had with a handful of rifles, I don't think you, if you want to go tune it and you want to be that guy and you want to try 2/10 grain increments, yeah, like have out of power on. These things are expensive to shoot. They're not that fun.
Yeah.
But I think you can take it too deep.
Yeah.
I think it's a good time to take a step back, come at it from a very simple, practical perspective.
Right.
And
like what they were designed to be.
Right. And honestly, I would even say like there's a lot of data available. I will bring up, you want to pay attention if you're weighing out your charge versus if it's volumetric.
You know,
look at the load data. Is that by volume or is that by weight? Because with muzzle loaders, it's presented sometimes both ways. So depending on the charge, the propellant type that you're using, make sure you're paying attention to that.
Yeah.
But like Blackhorn 209, generally speaking, you know, if you go off their data, what would be equivalent of like a 3.77 pellet 150 grain charge, mm-hmm, by weight is about 84 grains of Blackhorn.
Got it.
So I'd actually weigh out 84 grains on my scale.
Yeah.
Pre-charge these tubes, and I'm not going to go try 78 grains and 80 grains and 82 grains and be like, oh man, this got better accuracy. No, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you might try 75, you might try 80, you might try 84.
Got it.
Honestly, I generally go to 84 and that's where I shoot it, and I'm able to get good accuracy. I don't even mess around with it. You know, with my ultimate muzzleloader, I go much higher than that. I'm not going to say what that charge is. But it would be the equivalent of 200 grains of 777 pellet, 4 pellets,
yeah,
with Blackhorn. Blackhorn doesn't build as much pressure, though. That's pretty neat about it. You can get velocity. Like, I bring this up. Like, if we set up a PV barrel, pressure velocity barrel, with a transducer, and we're actually measuring chamber pressure of muzzleloaders, mm-hmm, if we baseline it with 3 777 pellets or 4 777 pellets, and then we go to Blackhorn and we just match velocity, we can match the velocity of the 777 at a much lower pressure, mm-hmm, with the Blackhorn propellant versus the 777, even whether it's loose or pelletized, which is kind of interesting. But it's a great powder. It's super clean, super consistent, usually able to get really good accuracy with it, low standard deviations. I'm a big fan of Blackhorn. I wish it was a little bit easier to get and a little bit less expensive.
Yeah.
I think most people in the facility have switched over.
Yeah.
Because everyone just sees the benefits. Like Greg said, super clean. I sighted in my rifle. I shot that deer in Colorado. I actually loaded another round because I didn't know if I would have to put a second one in it. I didn't. I kept it loaded for over a year. I shot it this month.
This is the expert.
Yeah.
Shot it this month.
There's a reason he's an engineer and not a ballistics lab guy.
That's right.
I'm not very good at it.
Out of the lab.
Yeah. But I set up at 200 yards and hit the steel plate right on. And then since then, I've loaded another 4 or 5 rounds. I haven't had to clean once.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will bring up this. You reminded me of something.
That would say, so with those fire sticks, that's one thing I will say is they are dirty. Like, you get 2 rounds through it and like you can barely get another sabot down there.
Yeah.
Super dirty.
You just made me think of a little tip, a little bit of information I'm going to share. We have found by doing a lot of muzzleloader testing in the lab, and I think this goes across the board, but I use this with Blackhorn and my Ultimate, or if I'm shooting somebody else's, you know, I've done a lot of work with like CVA Acuras, even the Paramounts. Clean your gun. Go shoot 2 fouling shots. Ignore them as far as point of impact. Yeah. Don't be adjusting your sights or your scope off those first shots. Don't be looking at velocity. And then do your 3 or 5 shot groups for record, both for point of aim, point of impact, and adjusting your sights, and for looking at your average velocity to determine your downrange ballistics. I think you will save yourself a lot of headache if you can get yourself to just say, I'm going to clean it, I'm going to shoot the 2 fouling shots,
yeah,
and then I'm going to shoot my shots for record. There's your little tip.
Okay.
So I got one more tip that's pretty important. Don't be like me and leave your gun, well, over a year.
I thought we learned that tip like 3 minutes ago.
Right. It's corrosive. It's not good. Yeah. I mean, they're better now. Right. Blackhorn is quite a bit better.
If it was Powered X, you'd be a little screwed.
Yeah.
I might have done that with a muzzleloader one time. It might have sat in a closet for like 2 years.
I'm not the only one.
I was also like 17, not 30.
I mean, I'm youthful.
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing I don't miss with the old Pyrodex. I don't know if you ever shot Pyrodex.
I don't think so.
But it was like rotten egg, stinky smell.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Remember cleaning your gun?
Yeah.
And you had to use like all the water and the soaps and the, it reeks so bad.
All right. All right, what's your tip?
So the tip, when you leave your rifle loaded, you forget about it. And then you go to the next year and then you're like, okay, I need to load my rifle. And then you load more powder and another bullet on top and then you blow up your gun.
That's, potentially, or at least damage
your
gun.
Is that also a first-hand experience?
No, I've never done that. Because I've seen people, I can't remember, it was a friend of a friend or something here, it was on YouTube.
Friend.
Anyways, he destroyed his rifle, and yeah, it's pretty common, actually.
No, it really
did like the Elmer Fudd thing, and it split open.
Yeah, and if nothing else, you're just going to stress the material, the receiver. You know, most modern receivers that are built well can even kind of withstand it to the point of protecting the shooter from not having injury.
Right.
But your gun's destroyed.
Yeah,
you've always stressed the material and potentially cracked frames, those kind of things. Generally, you're not going to like completely split a barrel, but you could. I mean, you look at some of the inlines. I'm not going to dog on any gun in particular, but like there was a lot of very inexpensive, cheap built inlines do not have a very strong lockup mechanism.
I mean,
for receiver, and I wouldn't want to fire one of those with a double charge double projectile.
You pick them up and they weigh 4 pounds, it feels like, and they're just like plastic made.
Yeah, just thin material on the receiver and the bolt design. Like I said, they're not strong. They're not designed to withstand high pressure. But good point. I think if you're at home at the loading bench with rifle, you've got to pay attention, right? The same thing. You know, it's not the time to be distracted. It's not the time to be multitasking.
Yeah.
Pay attention to what you're loading. And the same thing with muzzle loaders. Pay attention. I mean, a lot of guys are used to just, and I've actually seen that quite a bit. There's a lot of people, a lot of hunters, a lot of shooters that are not hand loaders.
Yeah.
Right? They shoot factory loaded ammunition, but they use muzzle loaders. And muzzle loaders is probably the first time they've ever really interacted with multiple components, right? Propellant, projectile, primer. And all of a sudden, it's not as easy as taking a loaded cartridge and putting it in my magazine or into my chamber.
Right.
You've got to pay attention to, did I load the powder? Did I put the bullet in it? You know, it's not the time to be distracted. Just something to think about.
Yeah. So the way to mitigate that is you take your ramrod and you put tape around it where it bottoms out. So on a clean barrel, you put your powder in, put your bullet in, put the ramrod down, and then you mark. You can Sharpie it or put a piece of tape, and then you know, that's where I need to be. Because sometimes when the bore starts to get tight, when it gets fouled, you don't know if you're at the bottom. You're pushing, it gets hard, and you're not bottomed out. If your tape isn't exactly at the muzzle, then you know, okay, I got to go more.
Yeah.
Or if you double charge it, all of a sudden it's quite a bit above the muzzle, then you got a big issue. So that's another safety thing and kind of a double check to prevent that.
Yeah.
How would you get out a double charge if you had to?
Depends on the gun. A lot of them, you just got to disassemble it.
Got it.
Dump the powder out. You're probably going to pull your breech plug. You're going to have to push your projectile out with a rod.
Okay.
You know, it's going to be not ideal, but it's doable. Don't go fire it.
Yeah.
Get help if you need to. Talk to a professional.
Talk to a gunsmith.
Yeah. Go to a gunsmith. Get somebody that knows what they're doing. Like,
the CVAs, you can just twist the breech plug out. Yeah, they're easy enough. Keep pushing your ramrod, ultimate muzzleloader. Breech plug comes out with the tool.
Yeah.
Can't remember all those. I think like the Hawkins, I think you're kind of screwed because they don't, some guns don't have removable breech plugs,
right?
But don't shoot it.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. It, yeah. There's actually some cool stuff. I will say, TC, Greg Ritz did a recent video and this was TC specific with the Encore to kind of show off the strength, but they actually have a pretty interesting video on YouTube that shows they actually purposely go double charge the muzzle loader and fire it, you know, safe conditions, obviously removing the shooter from the event.
Yeah.
But yeah, get on and watch. It's kind of cool, kind of interesting, but good reminder to pay attention to what you're doing.
Absolutely. Okay. Final thoughts. Here we go. If you had your once in a lifetime tag for, I'm gonna give you deer and you elk, just because I know that we normally swap that. If you had a once in a lifetime deer tag and you had to go shoot it with the muzzle loader, obviously you drew a muzzle loader tag. Which one are you picking and why?
I'm going to choose the Magnum MZ.
Okay.
It shot the best for me.
Yeah.
Sometimes that TEZ can be I don't know. I've just gotten better accuracy with the Magnum MZ.
Okay.
Just as a rule of thumb, and the 250 grains is plenty.
Do you feel like you really see any difference if you're shooting deer versus elk? Don't care. Just
I'd shoot the same.
Got it. Once in a lifetime elk tag.
Magnum MZ all Magnum day long. MZ. Even at 250 grain, I wouldn't worry about stepping up to the 290 grain or 300 grain offerings. I've killed some big hogs with muzzleloader, both 250 and 290 grain. I would go with a Magnum for the accuracy in my ultimate muzzleloader.
Yeah.
I push that bullet at 2,400 feet per second. It loads awesome. It shoots great. Like I said, with the scope, I'm literally sub MOA. I recently put some Williams Western Precision sights on my gun.
Yeah.
To have a solution that's legal in Utah as well as hopefully Colorado. Maybe we're going to go hunt some elk next year. And even with those, you know, it's kind of like an aperture globe front sight. I mean, I was shooting 2-inch groups at 100 yards with that Magnum MZ at 2,400 feet per second. So I'm not going to complain. Awesome. I know what that bullet does on game when it hits as well. The expansion, the weight retention, it's still going to penetrate on an elk with that 250 grain. That's what I'm going to pick.
Okay.
Those sights are the way to go, by the way.
They're awesome. Yeah. Recommendation from Mitchell. I've been looking at them for a while. I looked at red dots. I looked at prism scopes. Ended up going with that Williams Western Precision, and it's spot on. It's the way to go if you can't use a scope on a muzzleloader.
Are they a local Utah company?
No.
Where are they out of?
I don't know where they're at.
Where did you meet up with those guys? Was it here at Hunt Expo, or was that at NRA?
I don't think I ever met with them.
Well, no, you're talking Skinner. Skinner gotcha. Sites. They're okay. Out of Montana.
Gotcha.
Very cool guys. They unfortunately don't make a sight solution for my ultimate.
Got it.
And so maybe I went with this. They should. Skinner Sights, if you're listening, build me some cool sights for Remington Ultimate muzzleloader. I did go with them for my lever gun, though.
Oh, okay.
I've got the Skinner Express sight on my 1894 357. Nice. Awesome setup.
Okay.
I'm a fan of an aperture rear ghost ring, however you want to call it, sight with a front. You know, like my 357 is more of a post. Where this muzzleloader's got interchangeable inserts. You can go to like a fiber optic dot, a pin. You can go like, I've got an actual crosshair with like a holdover point.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Anything else that you guys want to throw in before we wrap her up?
Maybe. Use the 19th Owl green pin. That's the way to go.
On your Williams.
Yeah, it's kind of like a bow sight, like smaller pin size, 19.
Aim small, miss all.
Yeah.
Miss small.
Yeah, yes. The only other thing I'll say is we'll give a teaser.
Okay. What's your teaser?
Nothing specific. But we're very aware and very much on board and looking at some potential new products in the muzzleloader world.
Got it.
I'll leave it at that. You have to be patient, but we're working on some cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your guys' time today. I appreciate it. And thanks for everyone listening to another Barnes Bullets podcast.